7. Cardinal Fulton Statler Harms, chief prelate of the vast organizational network that comprised the Christian Islamic Church, could not for the life of him figure out why there wasn't a sufficient amount of money in his special discretionary fund to cover his mistress's expenses. Perhaps, he pondered as his barber shaved him slowly and carefully, he had too dim a notion of the extent of Deirdre's needs. Originally, she had approached him, no small task in itself, since it involved ascending the CIC hierarchy rung by rung, ascending without falling entirely off before reaching the top. Deirdre, at that time, represented the WCLF, the World Civil Liberties Forum, and she had a list of abuses. It was hazy to him then, and it was still hazy to him, but anyhow, the two of them had wound up in bed, and now, officially, Deirdre had become his executive secretary. For her work, she blotted up two salaries, the visible one that came with her job, and the invisible one doled out from the substantial account that he was free to dispense as he saw fit. Where all this money went after it reached Deirdre, he hadn't the foggiest idea. Bookkeeping had never been his strong suit. "You want the yellow removed from this gray on the side, don't you?" his barber said, shaking up the contents of a bottle. "Please," Harms said. He nodded. "You think the Lakers are going to snap their losing streak?" his barber said. "I mean, they acquired that what's-his-name. He's 9 feet 2 inches. If they hadn't raised the..." Tapping his ear, Harms said, "I'm listening to the news, Arnold." "Well, yeah, I can see that, Father," Arnold the barber said as he splashed bleach onto the chief prelate's graying hair. "But there's something I wanted to ask you about homosexual priests. Doesn't the Bible forbid homosexuality? So I don't see how a priest can be a practicing homosexual." The news that Harms was attempting to hear had to do with the health of the Procurator Maximus of the Scientific Legate, Nicholas Bulkowski. A solemn prayer vigil had been formally called into being, but nonetheless Bulkowski continued to decline. Harms had, sub rosa, dispatched his personal physician to join the team of specialists attending to the procurator's urgent condition. Bulkowski, as not only Cardinal Harms but the entire Curia knew, was a devout Christian. He had been converted by the evangelical charismatic Dr. Colin Passim, who at his revival meetings often flew through the air in dramatic demonstration of the power of the Holy Spirit within him. Of course, Dr. Passim had not been the same since he sailed through a vast stained-glass window of the cathedral at Metz, France. Formerly, he had talked occasionally in tongues, and now he talked only in tongues. This had inspired a popular TV comic to suggest that an English glossolalia dictionary be brought out, so that folks could understand Dr. Passim. This in turn had given rise to such indignation in the pious that Cardinal Harms had it jotted down on his desk calendar somewhere that, when possible, he should pronounce the comic anathema. But, as usual, he had not gotten around to such petty matters. Much of Cardinal Harms's time was spent in a secret activity. He had been feeding St. Anselm's Proslogion to the great artificial intelligence system Big Noodle, with the idea of resurrecting the long-discredited ontological proof for the existence of God. He had gone right back to Anselm and the original statement of the argument, unsoiled by the accretions of time. Anything understood must be in the intelligence. Certainly, too, the being greater than which none can be conceived cannot exist in the intellect alone, for if it were only in the intellect, it could be conceived as existing also in reality, and this would be to conceive a still greater being. In such a case, if the being greater than which none can be conceived is merely in the intelligence and not in reality, then this same being is something than which one could still conceive a greater, i.e., one which exists both in the intelligence and in reality. This is a contradiction. Consequently, there can be no doubt that the being greater than which none can be conceived must exist both in the intelligence and in reality. However, Big Noodle knew all about Aquinas and Descartes and Kant and Russell and their criticisms, and the AI system also possessed common sense. It informed Harms that Anselm's argument did not hold water, and presented him with page after page of analysis as to why. Harms's response was to edit out Big Noodle's analysis and seize upon Hartshorne and Malcolm's defense of Anselm. Videlicet, that God's existence is either logically necessary or logically impossible. Since it has not been demonstrated to be impossible, which is to say, the concept of such an entity has not been shown to be self-contradictory, then it follows that we must of necessity conclude that God exists. Upon fastening onto this weary argument, Harms had dispatched a copy via his direct line to the ailing Procurator Maximus as a means of instilling new vigor in his co-ruler. "Now take the giants," Arnold the barber was saying as he valiantly tried to bleach the yellow from the cardinal's hair. "I say you can't count them out. Look at Eddie Tubbs' ERA for last year. So he has a sore arm. Pitchers always get sore arms." The day had begun for the chief prelate, Cardinal Fulton Statler Harms, trying to hear the news, meditating simultaneously on his enterprise vis-à-vis St. Anselm, sending off Arnold's baseball statistics. This constituted his morning confrontation with reality, his routine. All that remained to make it the platonic archetypal beginning of his activity phase was the mandatory and futile attempt to pin down Deirdre regarding her cost overrun. He was prepared for that. He had a new girl waiting in the wings. Deirdre, who did not know it, was about to go. At his resort city on the Black Sea, the Procurator Maximus walked in slow circles as he read Deirdre Connell's most recent report on the chief prelate. No health problems assailed the Procurator. He had allowed news of his medical condition to leak its way into the media so as to ensnare his co-ruler in a web of self-serving lies. This gave him time to study his intelligence staff's appraisal of Deirdre Connell's daily reports. So far, it was the educated opinion of everyone who intimately served the Procurator that Cardinal Harms had lost touch with reality and was lost in harebrained theological quests, journeys that led him further and further away from any control over the political and economic situation that was pro forma his purview. The fake reports also gave him time to fish and relax and sun himself, and figure out how to depose the cardinal in order to get one of his own people into the position of chief prelate of the CIC. Bukowski had a number of SL functionaries in the Curia, well-trained and eager. As long as Deirdre Connell held down the post of executive secretary and mistress to the cardinal, Bukowski had the edge. He felt reasonably certain that Harms owned no one in the scientific legate's top positions, owned no reciprocal access. Bukowski had no mistress. He was a family man with a plump, middle-aged wife and three children all attending private schools in Switzerland. In addition, his conversion to Dr. Passim's enthusiastic nonsense, the miracle of flying had of course been achieved by technological means, was a strategic fraud designed to lull the cardinal deeper into his grand dreams. The Procurator knew all about the attempt to induce Big Noodle to come up with verification of St. Anselm's ontological proof for the existence of God. The topic was a joke in regions dominated by the scientific legate. Deirdre Connell had been instructed to recommend to her aging lover that he spend more and more time in his lofty venture. Nonetheless, although wholly rooted in reality, Bukowski had not been able to solve certain problems of his own, matters which he concealed from his co-ruler. Decisions for the SL had fallen off among the youth cadres during recent months. More and more college students, even those in the hard sciences, were finding for the CIC, throwing aside the hammer and sickle pin and donning the cross. Specifically, there had developed a paucity of arc engineers, with the result that three SL orbiting arcs with their inhabitants had had to be abandoned. This news had not reached the media, since the inhabitants had perished. To shield the public from the grim news, the designations of the remaining SL arcs had been changed. On computer printouts, the malfunctions did not appear. The situation gave the semblance of normality. "At least we did eliminate Colin Passim," Bukowski reflected. "A man who talks like an odd tape of a duck played backward is no threat." The evangelist had, without suspecting it, succumbed to SL advanced weaponry. The balance of world power had thus been made to shift ever so slightly. Little things like that added up. Take, for instance, the presence of the SL agent duped in as the Cardinal's mistress and secretary. Without that, Bukowski felt supremely confident. The dialectical force of historic necessity was on his side. He could retire to his floating bed half an hour from now with a knowledge that the world situation was in hand. "Cognac," he said to a robot attendant. "Courvoisier Napoleon." As he stood by his desk, warming the snifter with the palms of his hands, his wife, Galina, entered the room. "Make no appointments for Thursday night," she said. "General Yakir has planned a recital for the Moscow Corps. The American chanteuse Linda Fox will be singing. Yakir expects us." "Certainly," Bukowski said. "Have roses prepared for the end of the recital." To a pair of robot servants, he said, "Have my valet de chambre remind me." "Don't nod off during the recital," Galina said. "Mrs. Yakir will be hurt. You remember the last time." "The Penderecki abomination," Bukowski said, remembering well. He had snored through the Quia Fecit of the Magnificat, and then read about his behavior in intelligence documents a week later. "Remember that as far as informed circles know, you are a born-again Christian," Galina said. "What did you do about those responsible for the loss of the three arks?" "They are all dead," Bukowski said. He had had them shot. "You could recruit replacement from the UK. "We will have our own soon. I don't trust what the UK sends us. Everyone is for sale. For instance, how much is that chanteuse now asking for her decision?" "The situation is confused," Galina said. "I have read the intelligence reports. The Cardinal is offering her a large sum to decide for the CIC. I don't think we should try to meet it." "But if an entertainer that popular were to step forth and announce that she had seen the white light and accepted sweet Jesus into her life..."
"You did."
"But," Bukowski said, "you know why." As he had accepted Jesus solemnly, with much pomp, he would presently declare that he had renounced Jesus and returned, wiser now, to the SL. This would have a dire effect on the Curia, and hopefully even on the Cardinal himself. The chief prelate's morale, according to SL psychologists, would be shattered. The man actually supposed that one day everyone associated with the SL would march up to the various offices of the CIC and convert. "What are you doing about that doctor he sent?" Galina said. "Are there any difficulties?" "No." He shook his head. "The forged medical reports keep him busy." Actually, the medical information presented regularly to the physician whom the Cardinal had sent were not forged. They simply pertained to someone other than Bukowski, some minor SL person genuinely sick. Bukowski had sworn Harms's physician to secrecy, pleading medical ethics as the issue. But of course, Dr. Duffy covertly dispatched detailed reports on the procurator's health to the Cardinal's staff at every opportunity. SL intelligence routinely intercepted them, checked to make sure they painted a sufficiently grave picture, copied them, and sent them on. By and large, the medical reports traveled by microwave signal to an orbiting CIC communications satellite, and from there were beamed down to Washington, D.C. However, Dr. Duffy, in a periodic fit of cleverness, sometimes simply mailed the information. This was harder to control. Imagining that he was dealing with an ailing man, and one who had decided for Jesus, the Cardinal had relaxed his stance of vigil regarding the higher activities of the SL. The Cardinal now supposed the procurator to be hopelessly incompetent. "If Linda Fox will not decide for the SL," Galina said, "why don't you draw her aside and tell her that one day, on her way to a concert engagement, her private rocket, that gaudy plush thing she flies herself, will go up in a flash of flaming fire?" Gloomily, Bukowski said, "Because the Cardinal got to her first. He has already passed the word to her that if she doesn't accept sweet Jesus into her life, bichlorides will find her whether she wants to accept them or not." The tactic of poisoning Linda Fox with small doses of mercury was an artful one. Long before she died, if she did die, she would be as mad as a hatter. Literally, since it had been mercury poisoning, mercury used to process felt hats, that had driven the English hatters of the 19th century into famous organic psychosis. I wish I had thought of that, Bukowski said to himself. Intelligence reports stated that the chanteuse had become hysterical when informed by a CIC agent of what the cardinal intended if she did not decide for Jesus. Hysteria and then temporary hypothermia, followed by a refusal to sing Rock of Ages in her next concert, as had been scheduled. On the other hand, he reflected, cadmium would be better than mercury because it would be more difficult to detect. The SL secret police had used trace amounts of cadmium on persons for some time, and to good effect. Then money won't influence her, Galina said. I wouldn't dismiss it. It's her ambition to own Greater Los Angeles. Galina said, but if she is destroyed, the colonists will grumble. They're dependent on her. Linda Fox is not a person. She is a class of persons, a type. She is a sound that electronic equipment, very sophisticated electronic equipment, makes. There are more of her. There will always be. She can be stamped out like tires. Well, then don't offer her very much money, Galina laughed. I feel sorry for her, Bukowski said. How must it feel, he asked himself, not to exist? That's a contradiction. To feel is to exist. Then he thought, probably she does not feel, because it is a fact that she does not exist, not really. We ought to know. We were the first to imagine her. Or rather, Big Noodle had first imagined the fox. The AI system had invented her, told her what to sing and how to sing it. Big Noodle set up her arrangements, even down to the mixing, and the package was a complete success. Big Noodle had correctly analyzed the emotional needs of the colonists and had come up with a formula to meet those needs. The AI system maintained an ongoing survey, deriving feedback. When the needs changed, Linda Fox changed. It constituted a closed loop. If suddenly all the colonists disappeared, Linda Fox would wink out of existence. Big Noodle would have canceled her, like paper run through a paper shredder. Procurator, a robot serving assembly said, coasting up to Bukowski. What is it? He said irritably. He did not like to be interrupted when he was conversing with his wife. The robot serving assembly said, Hawk. To Galina, he said, Big Noodle wants me. It's urgent. You'll excuse me. He walked away from her rapidly and into his complex of private offices where he would find the carefully protected terminal of the AI system. The terminal indeed pulsed, waiting for him. Troop movements? Bukowski said as he seated himself facing the screen of the terminal. No, the artificial voice of Big Noodle came with its characteristic ambience. A conspiracy to smuggle a monster baby through immigration. Three colonists are involved. I monitored the fetus of the woman. Details to follow. Big Noodle broke the circuit. Details when? Bukowski said, but the AI system did not hear him, having cut itself off. Damn, he thought. It shows me little courtesy. Too busy deconstructing the ontological proof of the existence of God. Cardinal Fulton Statler Harms received the news from Big Noodle with his customary aplomb. Thank you very much, he said as the AI system signed off. Something alien, he said to himself. Some sport that God never intended should exist. This is the truly dreadful aspect of space migration. We do not get back what we send out. We get in return the unnatural. Well, he thought, we shall have it killed. However, I will be interested to see its brain print. I wonder what this one is like. A snake within an egg, he thought. A fetus within a woman. The original story retold. A creature that is subtle. The serpent was more crafty than any wild creature that the Lord God had made. Genesis chapter 3, verse 1. What happened before is not going to happen again. We will destroy it this time, the evil one, in whatever form it now has taken. He thought, I shall pray on it. "Excuse me," he said to his small audience of visiting priests who waited outside in the vast lounge. "I must retire to my chapel for a little while. A serious matter has come up." Presently he knelt in silence and gloom, with burning candles off in the far corners, the chamber and himself hallowed. "Father," he prayed, "teach us to know thy ways and to emulate thee. Help us to protect ourselves and guard against the evil one. May we foresee and understand his wiles, for his wiles are great, his cunning also. Give us the strength, lend us thy holy power, to ferret him out wherever he is." He heard nothing in response. It did not surprise him. Pious people spoke to God, and crazy people imagined that God spoke back. His answers had to come from within himself, from his own heart. But, of course, the Spirit guided him. It was always thus. Within him, the Spirit, in the form of his own proclivities, ratified his original insight. "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live," included in its domain the smuggled mutation. Witch equaled monster. He therefore had scriptural support. And anyhow, he was God's regent on earth. Just to be on the safe side, he consulted his huge copy of the Bible, rereading Exodus 22, verse 17. "Thou shalt not suffer a sorceress to live." And then for good measure he read the next verse. "Whosoever lieth with a beast shall surely be put to death." Then he read the notes. Ancient witchcraft was steeped in crime, immorality, and imposture, and it debased the populace by hideous practices and superstitions. It is preceded by provisions against sexual license and followed by condemnation of unnatural vice and idolatry. Well, that certainly applied here. Hideous practices and superstitions, things spawned by intercourse with non-humans on far-off foreign planets. "They shall not invade this sacred world," he said to himself. "I'm sure my colleague, the Procurator Maximus, will agree." Suddenly, illumination washed over him. "We're being invaded," he realized. "The thing we've been talking about for 2 centuries. The Holy Spirit is telling me. It has happened." "Accursed spawn of filth," he thought. Rapidly he made his way to his master chamber, where the direct and highly shielded line to the procurator could be found. "Is this about the baby?" Bukowski said when contact, in an instant, had been established. "I have retired for the night. It can wait until tomorrow." "There is an abomination out there," Cardinal Harms said. "Exodus 22, verse 17. Thou big noodle won't let it reach earth. It must have been intercepted at one of the outer rings of immigration. God does not wish monsters on this, his primary world. You, as a born-again Christian, should realize that." "Certainly I do," Bukowski said with indignation. "What shall I instruct Big Noodle to do?" Bukowski said, "It's what will Big Noodle instruct us to do, rather, don't you think? We will have to pray our way through this crisis," Harms said. "Join me now in a prayer. Bow your head." "My wife is calling me," Bukowski said. "We can pray tomorrow. Good night." He hung up. "O God of Israel," Harms prayed, his head bowed, "protect us from procrastination and from the evil that has descended on it. Awaken the procurator's soul to the urgency of this, our hour of ordeal." "We are being spiritually tested," he prayed. "I know that is the case. We must prove our worth by casting out this satanic presence. Make us worthy, Lord. Lend us thy sword of might. Give us thy saddle of righteousness to mount the steed of..." He could not finish the thought. It was too intense. "Hasten to our aid," he finished, and raised his head. A sense of triumph filled him, as if he thought, "We have trapped something to be killed. We have hunted it down. and it will die. Praise be to God.